Why did you make it so not to take a picture then the first time?
City names. you know, it, I guess when you get onto an idea, you at least I, to a fault almost, I like to see where it can go, and it was one of those when it struck me that it would be interesting. I guess I could preface that by, in the beginning of the process of actually making a movie, there was a point where there was a couple of scripts that were possible, and you do all of those things along the way that you decide, really kind of in a pedestrian way, this one has less actors that I have to find homes for, and that kind of thing. And I also had to look at the city that I was living in, because I had to shoot it where I was living. And a couple of the scripts, I really almost had to make Fort Wayne look more metropolitan than it was. And it made sense to me to use Fort Wayne to its best, in a way, by being the size that it was. And so in the company is going to fit the profile, ultimately, of a nice, tight, small cast, and the city works well in that context. But I really liked the idea of, in the general sense, not knowing where they'd come from or where they were or what it was that they did. It's often this sort of anonymous business babble. And so you start seeing how far, again, you can push that to the wall of, and ultimately, to me, it made sense that it might, with time, work as well as it does now, because it's not a time-specific movie. That it's not Saturday Night Fever. It's not something that represents a very small period in history. That looking at the American businessman from kind of the post-war, they looked relatively the same, and so it made sense to me to kind of invite that in and use that look to make an anonymous sort of society, and not hopefully make just a blanket statement. I don't think any one movie is going to speak for business today or anything like that, but it just, for the context I was using, both economically and artistically, it made sense.
So, are you trying to make a specific statement about business today, businessmen dealing with sort of like a new workplace?
You know, I think it ends up making a statement in its own way about that kind of thing, but it was really the context for a sort of love triangle that made sense to me that I hadn't seen before. I don't think it's the only backdrop that the movie would work in, but it was a good one, and it was one that I knew in a way I had temped before. I'd worked for a computer company, my brother and my father-in-law were in business. So it became a nice scenario in which to place my little story. And ultimately, you know, all you're really adhering to are dramatic rules. I didn't care to make a statement movie. I mean, there's much easier ways to probably go about doing that, or make a documentary about what I felt I saw in the workplace. But those things do come through that you mentioned, because of who you choose to be the intern. The intern was not color specific, ultimately, in the draft that we set out to film, but Jason, who played that, the intern, was a student. He was working on the film, and he said, I'd like to try out and be in it, and we used a number of local people, and when the opportunity unfurls itself, I looked at it and went, it was very Grinch-like in a way. I thought, why not? You know, as long as you've got a team like that, might as well go all the way with it, and ultimately it did help show the, you know, the kind of endless boundaries of his hatred, that it wasn't just women in that sense, that it wasn't just a minority, because Howard is the one who takes the brunt of his wrath. And the guys in the newsletter are seen that, again, doesn't drive the plot forward. It just helps reinforce this overall kind of pervasive sense that is kind of seeped into that workplace. But, and even in the visual contest, we tried to we added in the whole idea of the place being under construction. Well, it helped stretch our production budget by not having to dress certain parts of the set, but it also made sense, you know, in the way that you look at a pretty good, making this is a bad thing when you make analogies to far better things like Hamlet, but you know, when you look at a play like Hamlet, it's not just troubles at home, although ultimately at the core of it, the nucleus is a family having trouble. It's the whole place is diseased in a way. It's all pervasive. And so Chad's house is under construction, and in the workplace who's got water damage, and you try, you know, you just keep, I have one of those sort of formalist minds that keeps looking, how can I, you know, bookend things and make mirror images, and so it just, when you start that, unfortunately, you just keep growing, and that made sense again. It made sense to me.
So, along the lines of relationships with, you know, you said that the place is sort of indicating that the relationship is also sort of indicating the time and place. Right now, a lot of the summer movies that are out are all about, they have a lot of failing relationships in it. What do you think that is, and do you think this is sort of a timeless element that we're interested in? And, what was your take on that with writing this script?
Interested in it will remain to be seen. Everybody's interested in seeing it. But if, yeah, absolutely. You know, as long as we continue to have relationships, whatever gender mix they end up being, there will be difficulties because you have individuals trying to bond. I mean, the same way that you have individuals trying to fit into a mold in business, you know, you lose a bit of yourself when you go into a corporation and are asked to follow a sort of regimented, you know, a time-tested regimen. In the same way, you are giving of yourself, and there's growing pains in those situations. And ultimately, you know, she ends up, I think, being a means to an end. There's a real power conflict there between the two men, ultimately. And so it's as much about the failings of friendship as it is about emotional sexual relationship. So what looks to be the premise in the beginning is certainly not, I think, where it ends up going to. And I think we're susceptible to that today as we were 20 years ago or 30 years ago. To talk about openness and freedom and all those things, you know, often in free love of a number of years, it sounds good on paper, but it isn't always necessarily in practice. A thing that was a play that I really admire that dealt with that. It came out maybe at the end of that movement, but not certainly at the end of it, but dealt with Byron and Shelley, you know, and the idea that they were one of the original group of open, free love kind of people. And it showed, it's called Bloody Poetry. And it dealt with how difficult it was to make that in practice. And I think, you know, you see people who in this movie spend more time away from their loved ones than they do with them. And they're very successful at what they do, you know, desensitizing themselves and making the enemy way across the valley where you don't look into their eyes. And it's harder to have successful private relationships when your ethics become gelled into this kind of siege mentality, like win at all costs. It's hard to then go into a relationship and be willing to lose and be tender and show vulnerability where you spend 16 hours of your day not doing that.
Have you even had a bad experience in a corporate workplace?
No, not a bad one. It wasn't in it long enough, you know. But I always kind of was amused by the idea because I worked for this computer company that gave me a chance to go out to various companies and see how much alike they were and to. Even today, you see companies take these enormous numbers of employees and philosophies and try and combine them into one credo. You know, just do it is our moniker, and then that's not quite enough. We've got to slim it down some more. And now Nike has Go. You know, that speaks to the whole company and the whole, you know, their advertising thrust is all geared around that kind of thing. That win and wear Nike is all important. So it's being able to kind of just being a voyeur, I guess, in a way. When I went to school at NYU, I was living in Mount Kisco rather than in the city, so I rode the train back and forth and got a chance to see these people and that kind of became the visual motif for the movie as well, this idea that we only see time change by changing their ties, that the look stays the same, that they have this sort of, you know, armored coating, you know, Teflon white shirt that nothing fixed it. And it was interesting to me how, again, practically it made sense. All we have to do is buy some ties rather than buy a lot of food. But it made sense in a metaphorical context as well. But ultimately, I watched these people going in each day and feeling themselves as they went across the East River you know, shoot themselves out of this train like a cannon, you know, and go meet the day and then come back at the same time I was. I was after maybe a play rehearsal, you know, 15 hours later, and they were coming home. And, you know, it's like when you send your kid off to school, you just hope you've done it right because so many people are going to influence them at that point. But it was kind of interesting to watch these people almost, you could feel them like trying to change persona on the car, just really coming down. And it's an interesting dichotomy to watch, I guess. And so when I found that context for the relationship, it made sense as a nice way to say something about business and to say something about individuals.
I wonder, what's
part of
the
character
of that
the like
that and even now
that
it's totally opposite?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you say totally opposite, as a writer, I tried to set up opposites, you know. I mean, that's just the basic premise of dramatic structure, is that you're looking for opposing forces. And so if you have someone like Howard, well, what Howard seems to be in the beginning, it's important to have someone down the continuum so that they can clash and be after, you know, two different things, or after the same thing in this case, or seemingly the same thing. But to me, by the time we get to the end of the movie, I don't think Howard is so different. In fact, I kind of worry that if you throw a misogynist label at anybody, it may have to go toward Howard, because Howard, I at least believe what he says. Chad, by the end of the film, I'm not sure you can take anything that he said at face value. He has even lied to us as an audience. I think, you know, we think we're a step ahead of Howard, and by the end, ultimately, you are Howard. You have been duped in the same way. He's not given you the necessary information. And when we find out that Suzanne is actually back at home, I have to wonder if his male rage is just a show at the beginning as well, just to get that job, which I do believe that he wants. So the more information we get about Howard, the waiting outside the ex-girlfriend's house at 4 in the morning, and the fight on the floor to get the ring back, and then taking that ring and giving it to another woman, and the things that he says about her in the car, that, you know, there's a moment there of pure sort of clarity, you know, in a way that he could have walked away from this. If he actually did love her, he could have stepped back and waited to see if he knows Chad well, and if he seems to realize, oh, it's Chad, what's happened here, that if I step back, Chad will reveal himself. She'll find out soon enough. He could have walked away from the mess rather than, because of that, what he describes at the beginning, is, I can't stand to have somebody break up with me. He seems to kind of doomed to repeat this, you know, Sisyphus sort of thing over and over, because he doesn't learn from his mistakes. You know, the next time we see him, he immediately goes from 0 to 60. You know, it's just listen, listen, scream, scream. He's actually getting worse at it in a way. So I kind of find him actually vile in a way. He does the same things that Chad does. Nobody forces him to take on this game. It's not a power position thing that he has to. His boss is making him. And yet, he's spineless, and he says things about her character and her being that we never hear Chad say. Chad only reveals, I mean, I think he's a real manipulator and malevolent and what other tender phrases can I come up with, but he is a survivor as well, and as an abuser, I think he knows that his best camouflage is remaining underground, and he continually says, you know, this is between us, we don't want to expose how it works. And only when forced in the hotel room and in his own home at 1 in the morning does he say, you know, okay, you people just ask for it, here you go, this is how it works. Even on the bed, though, so he, right up to the last moment, he's trying to make up, well, we kind of win this, and then he goes, oh, forget it, this is too much work. So he never really, you know, even then takes her to task and says, your hand is dead, you don't deserve anybody the way that Howard does. So to me, they kind of gel somewhere toward the center in a way that I don't think you expect them to. They look much different in the beginning, and yet they look similar. They have the shirts on, and you're very careful to find ties that were quite similar in color. The pattern's a little different, but I tried to, as much as possible, in both their actions, what they did, like giving flowers to her and those kinds of things, that they were much more similar than you were led to believe in the beginning.
Even after we create victims.
Ultimately, a good victim, because you have to say victim because she doesn't have the necessary information. She doesn't know Chad is who he is, until she, or you know, you could argue that she doesn't want to believe she's who he is. But I also wanted a victim that was interesting, which is good, also interesting, because I think she's funny along the way. You know, she does. We have to react more than act in the movie. I mean, be active in the sense that she listens to what they're saying and. She doesn't spend a lot of time speaking in the film, but she's also not a clean bill of health. She is doing really what they are doing as well, even if it's not malicious. She is not telling the entire truth to those two men, and she is in fact voices at the end. I should have let you both know what I was doing, and I felt that I let this go too far because she has her reasons, and they're not reasons that are as immediately damning as motives like Chad and Howard. But I think also there's an interesting place that she comes to in the end that she has almost learned the game too well, that I don't believe she'll be able to have a relationship immediately because of what's happened to her, and she has actually been well taught in a way by the way they operate and has found a key to them that most of us don't possess. By not being deaf, that all she has to do is look away and she is in control. Now she controls the situation, and that's why at the end I decided to pull the sound out like that and finally show her perspective. I tried that actually several times in post-production. There was I don't know if you remember, there was a moment where there's the one triangular scene in the movie in the restaurant where Howard comes in by accident and surprises them, and there's this uncomfortable place where they're all lying to one another. And I cut to a reaction shot of her as she's trying to look at both of them. And he talks right into the camera, which is her, and says what she had said upstairs. You know, I got a lot of reports through the end of the month. It kind of grinds at home. Well, there was a little bit more of the scene that I filmed there where Chad is talking back over his shoulder. And each time he did that, I cut the sound out. So you kind of got the feeling of what it was like to be her. But it took the punch away from the end. You know, you'd seen the trick, and so I thought, well, I've got to save that for the end, because we don't have very many tricks. You know, that was our one special effect. So, it was fun.
I guess because when moments you got the feeling that suddenly those two were really
battling each other. Yeah, it was important, you know, to make that, to go from, and I think if you ever do get caught up in the movie, it's because it's, again, you're in Howard's kind of position. At the end of the day, a few drinks in you, I don't think you really believe that Chad was going to go through with that. It sounded like a kind of drunken, funny thing. And it's such a gradual, a very kind of boyish prank. It's Chad saying, oh, she talks like a dolphin, and we haven't really seen her talk yet, and it's the wrong secretary that he asks out. And it just slowly builds to be something a lot more serious than it was. It just seems kind of frat boyish in a way, even though Chad makes a distinction that they're not frat boys. They seem very much, you know, like frat boys. And elementary school boys in a way, but by the end it's become very serious, and then reinforcing that hopefully in the end when we see her cry for as long as she does on screen. I had somebody at a company who saw the movie kind of say that I was like Chad in a way, because Chad's not in the room anymore, and I'm just sitting there watching her cry, and they felt that I was being intentionally cruel myself. But it seemed important that, you know, you felt that this was serious, that there had been a cost, or there wouldn't be much of an emotional payoff. That even though they thought it was funny, or he thought it was funny, or whatever they felt, that somebody was actually being hurt by that. And so it made sense to me as a way to reinforce that.
A lot of times it feels like the root for the bad guy. What does it say about the group morale for one chap to see?
I'm not sure if there's anything good. You know, I've talked to people after this, and I said, God, I hate that Chad. And I think that's a relatively healthy, you know, feeling. I mean, that's a good litmus test that you're okay. I mean, if you felt that way, I'm going to give you an out. I think Aaron is responsible in a way for creating someone who, even though you maybe LaPelle is kind of by it, like him and what he's done. It kind of follows the lineage of people like, you know, Mastriani and someone especially like in Purple Noon, Alain Delon, who was killing people. But you wanted to see him get away, and ultimately I felt betrayed in the end of the film when they found the body trailing after the sailboat. I was like, you know, what a beautiful ending when he's just sitting there stunning in the beach and he did everything. He absolutely got away with it. And so it's a lovely kind of like Twilight Zone ending in its own way, but I felt betrayed for the character because I, in spite of myself, I was hoping he could drag those bodies around and hide them and learn how to make that signature. And I think it's the same kind of performance, you know, that you, even though you don't want to, you're engaged by the way he operates. You know, it's so detestable, you almost marvel at the design. It's like you can't quite believe that this man in the first 5 minutes can casually describe what he's going to do to everyone and then actually fulfill it. So, you know, I think it's a natural tendency that you want to feel that because we put those mantles, we make heroes out of, you know, it's the anti-hero came from. We take whoever we're given and we make something out of them. But ultimately, you know, my intent was that it's a pretty dismal portrait of, even though he's won, it's, you know, a victory, he's left sitting on his couch, a beautiful woman in the next room, and he's got his hand down his pants, and he's got a scratch, and listening to some bad cable show, and there's no one to share it with in the end. I mean, even in the sex that he's engaged in, he doesn't seem to be there. He's just kind of like staring off into the heavens. But there's no good partner for him because he can't be with himself, you know. And so that's where I was shooting for.
Yeah, I feel the fact that he got away, that makes a big difference.
I'm glad. I mean, I'm glad that, you know, that part is there. Yeah.
He still represents, I mean, it's disgusting. Again, it doesn't sort of seem like he does win out. I mean, he does seem by himself, but he doesn't seem to care. And his character, I mean, just as Aaron did such a good job, did you write, I know you guys knew this was a choice, did you write this part for him?
No,
within the body?
I didn't actually.
It
just, everything kind of came together, the chance to do it and he was available, and I knew he'd be good, and he fits my the profile of the event often interests me in thematically in work is that I think we do get a certain amount of room to the beautiful set that we don't want to believe that they're capable of, you know, of being you or I, you know, in the same way that the works in tragedy is that it's about kings and queens, you know, and that's what's scary, I think, back, you know, 2,000 years ago, that it was, that's where the idea of this catharsis came from, that if Oedipus can fall, imagine how far I can fall. And we look at the beautiful set together and say, really, the thing, those ugly things, I just can't imagine that they actually mean that. It's like going out with somebody who you find so attractive, and you think, well, she's probably just late. You know, it's not, you know, you're already on the edge here. Because, you know, you're not my favorite. I think we continually in this society, there's a great Henry Miller quote about the American ideal is youth. The American ideal is youth, beautiful and through youth. And that we constantly have this sort of standard that, you know, that some are above and the rest of us kind of float below.
I don't mean you, of course.
Aaron? No, you know, but he certainly fit the physical profile for me. I mean, you know, he happens to be a good actor, but he certainly looked idyllic to me in the role. And I wanted Chad to be someone that he looked at and had a certain number of charms about him. Because that makes it a, you know, by virtue of that, it was hard for us to discern when he was lying. He went to each scene with the purpose of making it seem like the truth to you, so that you as much believed that he was starting to fall in love with this woman as you believed that he hated those guys in the newsletter. Sure. How that happened?
Yeah, what are you looking for in this?
Well, in this arena, in a low budget arena, you often don't have the the ability to do a real, what you consider a casting call, or see a large number of people for anything. And frankly, I mean, I couldn't be happier, because I think the casting process is a difficult one anyway. It's when I enjoy, you know, picking actors, but for them, I think it's really kind of horrible, you know, where you're putting yourself on the line. And in this situation, I knew them or knew of them in various ways, and so it really ended up being just three phone calls that I made. They were the first people I went to and said, I'd like you to do this if you could, and they said yes. So it was very painless in that way, but they uniquely fit it. And again, it was back to kind of the, how did you come to this movie? It was by virtue of having three people that would fit it, and if they were going to do this other film, then I would still need three more people. Stacy had been in a play of mine at the Sundance Playwright Club, and so that was probably 5 years before we did the film, and I just kept her in mind, and I always thought she was exquisitely good, and she saw it as a real acting challenge that even included dialect, and that's how she really approached Christine, that I've got to learn this speech pattern, and so she spent a lot of time working out in California and with a teacher in Fort Wayne. And she just seemed ideal for it. And Matt, I knew his work through Good Machine here in the city. And they were trying to put a project together for the two of us, their short film that never came to fruition. But I had seen a number of things he did in, like Sparkle in a Vicious Circle and Surviving Desire, a couple of Tom Hartley things. He shows up on Law and Order now and then. But I knew of him, and I liked his work. And I knew he wasn't as visible as some other actors, and that is a very attractive thing to me, that I think one of the easiest ways into a movie like this is by not knowing the actors and quite immediately become the characters. I think Aaron's actually feeling the brunt of that now in a way that people are kind of responding almost negatively to him, in a way when they see him, it's like, oh, you are that guy, because they can't say, oh, I loved you as a football player in this. He's just Chad right now until he does some more work of that kind of visibility. I had seen him in a number of other plays, and so and then just been around him so I know the man, but ideally you don't have a stumbling block coming into the movie. You don't know me, you don't know them, and I think it's a nice way in, actually. But the process itself was quite easy. A couple of the other characters in the film are people that I went to college with at other places, and then there was some local casting.
Are you, and I said you should be, but with you releasing it, and some independent films that are out right now, last year was such a big independent year, and now there's a slew of independent films that are going to release. So how do you feel about that?
Good for everyone else. Worried for myself, just because because I'm new at it, for one, and I've never looked at it in the same way. I mean, I have followed it as being a film lover, but I never had to follow it for the same reason. So when I heard, oh, we're going to open in August, that I found unnerving. Knowing that there's other films out there that are good is unnerving. It's getting people to notice. It's a difficult these days because, like you said, there's so much product in and of itself. But there, an ad in the Times costs the same for Batman as it does for us. And so, being able just to remain visible enough. There's a certain core of people who will always follow movies in the way that I feel that I do. You know, you look to see what that can and what won the festival and what people are talking about. If you live in Fort Wayne, you read the New York Times because that's where most films open. But so here, the word maybe got to that group, but it's still untested as to how it will play in towns the size of Fort Wayne. Time will out in the end, but I'm excited because we've had at least some press that gets this visible. But it's a big tough neighborhood out there, so we'll just see. Hopefully next I'm going to do a play. I've got a play that I'd like to do here in the city. It hasn't been done here. It's been in Chicago and Los Angeles, and I'd like to tackle that, and I've got another screenplay that hopefully we'll start shooting in the fall.
Okay.
and the kind of relationship piece more as a liking him to different things. Not so much romantic comedy as a film more like, say, a Husbands and Wives or a Carnal Knowledge, kind of more severe look at private relationships. They're a little more evenly matched, I guess, you know, the for luxury. Right now, I could find a more uncommercial title, maybe Dead Lovers, but that, I think that has some of the question in the title, but there's also some commitments internationally, because the film opens both, you know, platforms in the States, but also opens kind of month after month elsewhere. There's some festivals that we still have to go to. So up until the end of the year, probably those three things. Babysitting the film on one side and trying to get those other two things done.
Some of the press I read for this movie, I've heard some people call it a
movie.
What do you think
that? I think that's as apt as anything else. I'm relatively cagey about those things. You know, I deliberately tried to make the film not middle of the road. Well, then that's not true. I'm one to want things to be, in a sense, what you want them to be. I don't think there's a yes or no answer. I think there are separate realities based on what you bring to it, and if your certain mindset and baggage is that that's what that will be, who am I to argue? You know, I think there are enough red herrings and enough clues along the way and enough elements of the ending that are not untidy but left to your speculation. I mean, I brought a lot in the way I shot the film and in the way I wanted the film to rest with an audience over from the theater. The beautiful thing about the theater is that connection with an audience, that very kinetic sort of, you know, a performance really relies on who's watching it. And in a way, leaving expectations unfulfilled and open to discussion is a place where an audience can then be interactive in a way. That you are a silent partner in a sense, and also you're left to say, no, I think it's this, and I think it's that. And maybe, you know, if you're lucky, think about it a little more than just out the door to your car. So Venice is as good a read as any, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not talking.
It's also being called the most misogynistic film.
It has been, yeah. Yeah, and I think that, God bless him. I often think that maybe at that point it's more the premise that's getting examined than the movie as a whole, but you're at the advantage of having started the whole mess. You know, you saw it through from the beginning, and so what may seem very evident to you may not read on the screen. So if that's the case, then I can't say I'm sorry. I can just say that, you know, I didn't do my job well enough because I had much larger game in mind. To have just one theme or one idea that you want to wrestle with seems a bit limited. You know, there's a number of threads there that I think it touches on homophobia and racism and power politics as a whole. More than it spends with misogyny. But the premise, I grant you, of a guy saying, hey, let's find some woman and really let her have hell, you can't get around the fact that that's misogynistic. And a big worry is, will that be the thing that fits most easily into the one-line description in the newspaper, where someone says, that's seems like a misplaced place to put my $8. Because I feel that at work. Why should I now be badgered when I go to the movie? So you hope that there's a way that it's encapsulated to represent the whole power ethic of it, rather than in the real simple outline of their plan.
Can you tell us about that?
Oh yeah. And I like it very much.
Yeah,
there was one that came out that same year that had a feeling similar. A Heart in the Winter, you speak French. Encore un hiver, yeah, beautiful. So, that also has a similar kind. In fact, that's two men, and you know, the one publisher in Let Us Fret is quite voyeuristic in a way. He's not an immediate, you know, player. So those two films kind of ran thought in there. That brings up pretty close. So, you know, so you better get going and get your thing done. So. But yeah. Thank you very much.